Well, I invite you to turn back to the book of Nehemiah, and God willing, we'll consider just the first four verses this morning. I've entitled the series, The Heart of a Reformer, and this morning's sermon will just be the man Nehemiah, but also looking at the introduction to this book. If you pick up a normal Bible, as we've done here this morning, you would find Nehemiah after Ezra and before Esther. This is because the book, as we're familiar with it, the Bible as we're familiar with it, is organized according to types of books. First, there is the law, the first five books, the books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Then there are the history books, which run from Joshua through to Esther. There are the books of poetry, Job to Songs of Solomon, including obviously Psalms, which is the largest book in the Bible. It always amazes me how, even though numerically it kind of falls near the start of the Bible, whenever you pick a Bible up and turn to the middle, it's always the book of Psalms. It's a great way to find your way around the Bible. Then you have the major prophets from Isaiah to Daniel, and finally the minor prophets, Hosea to Malachi. No comment on the person themselves, whether they're major or minor. It's down normally to the length of the book. The longer prophets or the prophecies come first, and then the shorter ones afterwards. But if you had a chronological Bible, a Bible that is arranged in date order as far as we can work it out, Nehemiah is actually the second to last book of the Old Testament. And this is key to understanding it. If I can rehearse very briefly the history of Israel, the promises that were given to Abraham, that his descendants would be as numerous as the stars in the night sky. Jacob's 12 sons following after him would become the 12 tribes of Israel. Then there was Egypt. They went in as 70 souls in a time of drought, stayed some 400 years, which I'm sure most of us would know would be, they would be as slaves in the land of Egypt, and then were freed by the Lord, working through Moses. Then they were led through the wilderness to return to the promised land, which was promised to Abraham all those years before, that though he dwelt in tents in the land and he didn't own it by any way, shape or form, yet God promised that it would be given to his children, to those generations who would follow after. But then there is the generation who left Egypt, the 600,000 adult men who were promised, or who rather left the land of Egypt. And yet of those 600,000, only two men actually entered into the promised land, because the people murmured and rebelled against the Lord. And then there was this 70 years of wandering around in the wilderness. Joshua, one of those two, and obviously Caleb, led the people into Canaan after Moses, of course, was not allowed into the promised land for a separate reason, but who carried on the leadership of the children of Israel, starting with Jericho and then fought the people of the land who would not submit to God's standards. Then there was the period of judges, men and women who were raised by God to deliver the people from their enemies and to lead them. Then, of course, the era of the kings, starting with Saul, who was the people's choice and who eventually ended up in infamy. But then David and his descendants, who were God's choice. But there was a problem. The people had developed a taste for idolatry. While the Ten Commandments themselves, that historic moment in the founding of Israel, were given, the children of Israel were making a golden calf and saying that that was the deity, if you like, or the representation of what had brought them out of the land of Egypt. And it didn't stop there when Moses destroyed the calf. When they reached the promised land of Canaan, the people of the land and the pagans round about, the Canaanites and all the other tribes that we read of in the Old Testament, were never fully subdued and conquered by the children of Israel, even though they were promised by God that if they did their part of the promise, if they actively went against the people of the land, if they tried to subdue the land, then the whole region would be given to them. But their courage failed. There were always pockets of resistance. There were idols accepted alongside the worship of the true God. Moses and Joshua warned the people repeatedly that God was a jealous God and would not tolerate being worshipped alongside other gods. But also the nature of the worship, as God puts it when he promises Abraham, the full abomination of the people of the lands of Canaan had not yet come fully through. The worship was abhorrent to God. Child sacrifices, temple prostitutes, both male and female, bestiality, drunken parties, superstitious beliefs, idolatries. These were all practiced by the nations round about. And it's not just even in the Bible that we see these things. These things are also borne up by studies that have been done of ancient people. God's people were to be different, to be distinct. The worship of the one true God being so much more noble. But you see throughout the history of Israel this following cycle. The people have a period of peace. Eventually the people of God forget God, coupled with when a faithful leader dies. The people turn to idolatry and the pagan gods. God warns and withdraws his hand of protection. The people ignore the warning. The Lord allows times of trouble and difficulty, and then the people remember the Lord and what he has done for them. They turn back to him, and the Lord delivers them. But you see throughout the Old Testament this cycle going round and round and round. I didn't count up how many times the cycle happens, but it's a good number of times, and you see it all the way through the children of Israel's history. But eventually, the Israelites disobey once too often. The Lord has been patient with them for many hundreds of years. Not years, not months, not days, but hundreds of years. With the passing of generations, this cycle carries on. And yet the Lord is still faithful to his people. But eventually, even he gives a final warning that if the people will not turn to him fully, will not forsake the gods completely, their fallen gods completely, he will send them into exile. Amazingly, even after all the hundreds of years, he gives them another 100 years to reform their ways. That's something like 3 or 4 generations that the Lord prophesies through his prophets, that he will judge the people, that he will send them into exile if they do not turn from their gods back to him fully. But instead, the prophets are ridiculed. We see from their prophecies, from their books that we have preserved for us in Scripture, the attitude of the people, that they would not listen. They did not think this trouble would befall them. But then the worst of all worst happens. The Lord raises up Babylon and King Nebuchadnezzar somewhere around the year 607, 605 BC. Jerusalem is leveled, the city. The gates, the symbol of power, are burnt with fire. The temple and Solomon and all its riches is leveled to the ground. The center of worship of Jehovah for the Jews. All the riches carried off to Babylon. The nobles and the middle classes are carried off into captivity, leaving only the poor of the land. And they're now prisoners of the superpower empire at the time, not free to worship as they will, humiliated and nationless. And they only have themselves to blame. You see their opinion, or rather their feelings, in Psalm 137. This is part of the backdrop to this book. And for 70 years, these people had to live in exile. Where they once wanted the gods around them, the gods of the pagans, they were now surrounded fully by them in the midst of an empire which did not regard their god whatsoever, but had their own deities, all their own beliefs. But God has not cast them off forever. And this is where the message gets more positive. He may have to chastise his people, but he will never give them up forever. The Lord always has his people in mind. The Lord raised up people like Esther, Daniel, even Jeremiah, the prophet, or rather Ezekiel, the prophet, who went into exile with them so that the people still had a reminder of their God, still had that ability to be able to receive messages from the Lord. For 70 years, there was this exile. And then amazingly, almost overnight, God brings about the first return to Jerusalem, overruling in the new king of that time, Cyrus, when the Persians took over the Babylonian Empire, overriding in Cyrus to allow people to return to Jerusalem. Their first target to be to raise the temple once more, to restore the glory and honour of Jerusalem at this time. Then you have the second wave, led by Ezra, who was a priest, returns to focus on getting the temple completed and up and running once more. You can see how the Lord is directing and overruling in situations to return the people once their exile is complete. And then there is that lovely verse in Ezra 3:12, where the old men, as it were, the ones who saw the temple, maybe as a child or young men, who saw the temple and knew what it was, they cry because this new temple is nothing like the old temple. But you also get the men born in captivity who are also crying with joy because the temple's there. It's restored once more. Yes, it's nothing like what it was, but it's not the pile of rocks and ruin that it was. Once again, true worship has been restored in Israel. It's a wonderful picture. And of course, the irony of this picture is that the young men who are weeping for joy over the temple being raised, that was the temple that Christ himself would walk in some 400 years later. It wasn't Solomon's temple, the first temple built. It was the second temple that actually knew Christ, the Saviour, walking as a man in the midst of it and teaching. I appreciate that's a very long introduction, but I trust it will be useful in setting the scene to Nehemiah 1. So we turn to the first three verses. At this point in the narrative, all we know is Nehemiah's name and that he was the son of what we presume is a godly man. Nehemiah means God's comfort or consolation. His father's name, interestingly, means he who waits for the Lord. So I think it's fair to assume that Nehemiah came from a believing family. We never should underestimate the influence that someone can have for generations to come. I don't want to get ahead of myself in the narrative here, but Nehemiah served Artaxerxes, who was the son of Xerxes, who was married to Esther. He would have been very familiar with Esther, his stepmother, even the very aged Daniel at this point. And it may have been why he had a Jewish cupbearer, as we're taught later on, because he came to know that the Jews were men and women of integrity who could be trusted with senior positions. And that was from a despot, from a tyrant. It could be that the memory you leave behind in your character, your witness or actions could have a big influence even after you've gone. Conversely, if you leave a poor witness, then it could influence people in a very different way. Oh, that we should be very careful how we walk and conduct ourselves before people. The Hebrew calendar, you may be interesting to know, works slightly different from ours. It works on cycles of the moon rather than how we run ours. 12 months, the same as us, all 29 to 30 days long, giving 354 days. And then an extra month is added every so often so that the days fall right. Why I'm saying this? Because as we have here, in the month Chislu, or Kislev as it can be pronounced, is around the time of November. That's key to understanding, because the next period, what we see in Nehemiah's life, is 4 months. It's very key to understanding what happens next. The palace of the Persian Empire was based at Shushan or Susa. Today it's called Shush and it's in Iran. Interesting that we have this with all that's going on in the news at this time. It's some 760 miles away from Jerusalem. And that again is key to understanding what happens next. A faithful man, a brother, maybe a physical brother, maybe a cousin, maybe just a countryman, comes with a group from Judah to the palace. It could have been a family member. Either way, it was a trusted person. And Nehemiah eagerly asked for updates. This would have been rare, and it's something we don't really understand in our day and culture today, where information is thrown at us left, right, and centre. You often think of the newspaper, the same day newspaper. In actual fact, the news is probably old in it because of all the electronic updates that we get. You think of the situation we have in Israel at the minute, in the war with Ukraine and Russia. We get updates almost before the governments of the day get updates, those of us who wish for such things. But in the ancient world, updates from far-flung parts of the empire, which would have been accurate, were very rare. It was some years between Ezra and Nehemiah. And Nehemiah and presumably the other Jews who took an interest in Jerusalem would have assumed that all was going well. After all, had not God overruled to allow the people to return? Was not God's promises over the work? Had not God provided all things that were necessary? Had not the groups of refugees or survivors, if you like, returned to Jerusalem? So therefore, all must be going well. Imagine Nehemiah's horror when he hears the news. The remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. Great affliction in the margin, great distress because of the evil that they are surrounded by. Reproach, that is to say disgrace, held in contempt. The walls of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. The walls of a city were its defence. It's what made it a city rather than a hamlet or a village. They were costly to build and maintain and afforded a city a certain level of prestige. Obviously, in times of war, they were a defence and a place of protection. The gates were held in particular significance. This was the place of business and politics. The elders of the city gathered at the gates to meet and have their councils. Anyone who wanted to go in and out of the city had to go via the gates. Before siege weapons were set up, the gates were the obvious place of attack and therefore the most fortified, with towers and ramparts. The news is basically this: the work has failed. The city is still in ruins. God's enemies are laughing at us. And that's the news that Nehemiah hears. What's his response? "And it came to pass when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned certain days and fasted." How did Nehemiah respond to this most shocking and terrible news? He sits down and he weeps. He mourns and he fasts. All signs of deep contrition and sadness. You almost expect him to hear, as you hear so often through the Bible, that he rent his clothes and scattered dust on his head, which was so many the way that people showed that they were mourning. But perhaps in the time and state that he is, it's not appropriate for him to do that. But it almost surprises you, those who are familiar with the Bible, that you don't read that phrase in there somewhere. My question to us today is this: do we mourn and weep over the state of things today? And by the way, before we go any further, this book works on so many different levels. It can be applied to a person's life, the need for reformation in a person's life, the need for a returning to the Lord, where the fire and zeal of a person have perhaps died down, where we've allowed too many things to come between us and the Lord, and we need that stirring of the coals of the embers once more. It can be related to the local church. And by the way, I'm not saying that there are any problems that I've seen here. Let me say that from the outset. But it's always good to be reminded of these things. But we also see it as well here in Nehemiah on a national scale, how the church of the Lord within a particular land, across the world, within a region, may need to return to the Lord once more because we have strayed. Think of the rise of sin around us. The majority of the people in this land do not believe in God. Instead, that they say there is no God or he is a fiction. Absolute morality, the idea of things being set in stone, is nonsense. But rather, we're free to make up our own minds over what is right and wrong, and we're free to do what we want. Abortion has come down to the rights of a woman. Forget the man who had a part in the child's birth. Forget the child, which is an entity in their own. Even in this news past, it looks as though in October, the month that I'm here, the government will be considering a vote on the starting of euthanasia. Religion is the cause of most wars. It's a way to control people. If you're religious, you're bigoted, you're narrow-minded and foolish. I was thinking about this in the light of the situation at the Middle East in present, and if people will use it as an excuse. But in reality, if you look at the situation that's happening, it's a war over land, over territory, as most conflicts are. There is no eternity. There is just the here and now. So do what you want. If you want pleasure or fun, do what you have to, even at the expense of others, to enjoy yourself. Think of the rise of material greed, the levels of hatred, the insatiable appetite for lust. Think of all the anti-God movements around us. But also think of the established church, in our case the Church of England, which is what most people will look to for some kind of spiritual guidance. May interest you to know that to be considered a regular at a C of E church, you only need to attend one meeting a month. Amazing that that counts as being someone who is actually faithful, who is actually dedicated to a local church, going just one meeting once a month. What is the overriding message of the established church as we see? Forget that most people don't believe in God. Forget that record numbers of priests and clergy are skeptical about God and the Bible, climate change, political statements, social works. Think of all the trouble that the C of E has come into, the record numbers of scandals and all the rest of it. The errors that are so great within the C of E church, you wonder how any truly saved believer can remain there. But also think of the Bible-believing world in the UK, the big denominations which almost in a lifetime have given over to liberal biblical criticism, have become compromised with ecumenical movements, the rise of so-called contemporary worship, which is anti-Bible and against the true nature of worship, the lack of gospel preaching, and the slide, in effect, into hyper-Calvinism. These things may not be held to, but by not having a regular gospel service, you're almost saying that we leave it to the sovereignty of God and man has no part to play whatsoever. The lack of desire for Sunday schools or to outreach into the local communities, the compromises into gimmicks we get in so many churches to get people in by other means, the lack of holding to biblical truth in case we offend or we make people uncomfortable, the number of people who have no true testimony of God's saving grace in their lives barely different to worldlings, and yet are allowed into churches to cause chaos amongst God's people, and the levels of spiritual illiteracy that even in supposed mature Christians so know so little about Bible teachings. Does it make you weep, dear friends, here this morning? Most of all, in our gospel days, does it make you weep that souls are perishing? Every moment of every day, souls are dying, are being pulled into eternity to stand before a holy God, and there is so little effort to save them. Most of all, that worship in so many places, especially in the UK, has become profane and unfit for God. A modern rock festival, emotional pleasing, anti-reverence, anti-order, verses from scripture twisted to allow this, or the standards completely ignored. These things should make us weep. We rejoice when we see things going right. We rejoice that there are parts of this world where there are faithful churches who are holding true to these things. We rejoice to see that. But it should also make us mourn and weep when we see so much of what is going on. What a time to be called to serve the God in this, the final age, the lukewarm era of the church. And prayed before the God of heaven. It's so easy to become overcome with sorrow about these things. We go either to two extremes. We either ignore the wider picture of what's going on around us and we cut ourselves off, choosing rather instead to enjoy the tiny blessings that we see in our lives. Or we go to the other extreme and bewail the times in which we live. This is so bad, this is so bad. We put ourselves into spiritual depression, so much so that we resolve not to do anything because we're so overcome. But what do we see in Nehemiah? And if we can say, the example of the heart of a reformer. He weeps, he sorrows, he mourns, he fasts, and then he prays. Where do we go to in times of distress and unrest? Maybe we're shaken to the core by something. Maybe it's some tragedy, some sin that we fall into. Maybe it's some trial, some difficulty, or like Nehemiah, something that spiritually causes us to fail. Do we just sit and sigh about it, or do we take it before the Lord? Nehemiah, as we will come to see, is a man of prayer. In times of distress, affliction, emergency, he always runs to prayer. Can it be said the same of our lives, that our first resort in times of trouble and difficulty is to go to the Lord? From every stormy wind that blows, from every swelling tide of woes, there is a calm, a sure retreat, 'tis found beneath the mercy seat. This is a place where Jesus sheds the oil of gladness on our heads, a place than all besides more sweet, it is the blood-stained mercy seat. There is a spot where spirit blends, where friend holds fellowship with friend, though sundered far by faith they meet around one common mercy seat. Whither shall we go for aid when tempted, desolate or dismayed? Or how the hosts of hell defeat had suffering saints no mercy seat? There on eagle wings we soar, and time and sense seem all no more, and heaven comes down our souls to greet, and glory in the mercy seat. Oh, let my hands forget their skill, my tongue be silent, cold and still, this bounding heart forget to beat, if I forget the mercy seat. I don't want to go too far into prayer, into the prayer of Nehemiah in this service. I want to keep that for the next one. But I also didn't want to leave it on such a down note. I wanted to raise it. So I wanted to speak about prayer. That Nehemiah acts like Hezekiah, gathers up all his problems, all his difficulties, all his sadnesses and pains, and spreads them before the Lord. Nehemiah, under the Lord's using, was going to restore Israel. It would be a difficult and hard journey because recovery from spiritual decline is always difficult. There are enemies who would wish we did not succeed. The people have grown used to idleness, as we shall see. There was much fearfulness in those who remained faithful. But through it all, there are so many rich blessings that we see. Just in the last few moments we have before us, I remind you of Ezekiel 37. This was the prophet of consolation. This was the prophet who saw the worst of the 70 years of exile. And what does he have to say about his vision, or the vision that he's given before the Lord? Dry bones cooked under the sun, no marrow, no moisture, but dry, bleached bones. Ezekiel, the prophet who accompanied the people into exile, for him he saw many bones. His people carried away into captivity, the temple destroyed and gone, Jerusalem burnt and desolate, and many thousands of people slain. He must have thought, how will the promises of God be fulfilled now that one who would be born, who would be Messiah, who would save the people from their sins? God in the vision asks, Son of man, can these bones live? You may think, what an odd question. Can dry bones live? Of course not. Humanly speaking, nothing can come from these bones. And that's what the prophet is led to say. And I answered, O Lord God, thou knowest. Our God is the God of the remarkable. He is not limited. His power is not weakened. He is able to do the impossible. That's why I started with rehearsing the history of Israel, how we see God time and time again stepping in for his people. God does not change. It's not even as though he does not change. God cannot change. The same God that we read of in the Old Testament, who did so much for his people, who will do so much for his people, as we will see in the studies to come, is the same God that we serve and love today. He is the same God who is overseeing every part of human history. Why? To bring his will around. God says in the prophet, in the vision to the prophet, "So I prophesied and he commanded me, and the breath came into them and they lived and stood up upon their feet, an exceeding great army." However grim things look to us, however far the church has gone over to the world, the Lord is able to restore things. We should never be without hope. And this is what Nehemiah holds fast to, as we see in coming studies. It's the same God that we serve today. As we come to conclusion then, I must apologize for the long introduction about the book of Nehemiah. I trust it's been useful to see the main purpose, but also the backdrop and how it will answer so many things and unlock so much about this book. I also apologize, there's been lots of sadness in this first message. God willing, the next part of the book we see a lot more positivity to come. But as I say, reformation must start with a reality check of where things are. In a church, it happens that we realize that people are not being saved. People are not coming in. There is not the blessing that we see in the Lord. On a national scale, how churches have declined and closed so much. In the heart of a person, those times where we once loved the Lord, where we knew such blessing, where we enjoyed his communion so much, where we prayed so easily, it was though God was almost in the room with us. He's with us all the time. But so easy prayer was, so easy where we obeyed the Lord, where we enjoyed him so much, and yet those things have grown cold. This is the focus of the book of Nehemiah, the heart of reformation. And just before we come to our final hymn, I hand over to Pastor for the communion service.